War Powers, Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. A presidential veto keeps the U.S. supporting the war in Yemen, and Yemenis wondering when it will end.
They see this war as the U.S.'s war in their country, as much as it is Saudis and the UAE's.
Also, as we wait for the Mueller report, what makes a secret worthy of redaction?
Most of the classified universe does not deserve to say secret more than a couple of years.
Plus, Japan wrestles with its attachment to whale meat.
There's a stand out front that sells whale cooked all sorts of ways. Fried, grilled, bacon style.
And gasping for oxygen at the top of Everest.
To put it simple, you probably start dying slowly. Just imagine like having a plastic bag over your head and your time is limited.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In one country, 10 million people are on the brink of famine today. More than 50,000 have been killed since 2015. Those are just two of the many ways to describe the human cost of the war in Yemen, a conflict that involves U.S. support for a Saudi-led coalition. A rare bipartisan push in Congress produced a resolution to end American involvement in the Yemen war. President Trump has now vetoed it. Trump called the resolution an unnecessary attempt to weaken his constitutional authorities.
I wouldn't say that it was unexpected.
Shireen Aladami was born in Yemen. She's now an assistant professor at Michigan State University.
Many of us have expected Trump to continue to support the Saudis in this brutal war in Yemen, but I think it's still devastating given the impact of U.S. involvement in Yemen and this lost opportunity, I think, for the U.S. to finally take some positive steps toward ending this war. So it's certainly devastating and disappointing, but not unexpected.
What have you heard from your friends and your family back home in Yemen?
Well, I think Yemenis have gone through multiple rounds of disappointment with different bills in the Senate, trying to build support for those and then them falling through. It took at least 2 years for this bill to even get through Congress, which seems to have been a huge feat. I think family and friends were excited at first, but they seem to have not been paying too much attention. Now they see this war, many of them see this war as the U.S.'s war in their country, as much as it is Saudis and the UAE's. And so I don't think anybody was really holding their breath. But certainly there's disappointment because people are still living under miserable conditions. They are still experiencing the devastation of this war. It's affecting their daily lives. And this is just one more step that is preventing them from hoping and living in a country where things might get better for them.
That was Yemeni-born Shireen Aladami at Michigan State University. David Miliband heads the International Rescue Committee. He's also a former British foreign secretary. Miliband says the failed congressional resolution had a simple point.
The point was that the war strategy that America is backing, some 19,000 bombing raids that have been run by the Saudi-led coalition with American support. That war strategy is failing in humanitarian terms, as I saw for myself, with widespread malnutrition, the world's second largest cholera outbreak. But it's also failing in political terms, in that precisely the people who President Trump wants to take on, the Iranians, the radicals, they're actually gaining from the war strategy. And that's why the decision of President Trump to stick with this failed strategy is so significant and so damaging.
What is this going to change on the ground?
It's a complicated and dangerous tinderbox, really. The result of the decision is to give a green light for a strategy that has been shown to fail. Now, it's important to acknowledge, to register, that in January of this year, the different parties came to talks under UN auspices to agree a ceasefire agreement for part of the country, for the port of Hodeidah, which is in the northwest of the country. It's under Houthi control. And it's an absolutely vital lifeline for humanitarian aid. 80% of the aid going into the country goes through the port of Hodeidah, but it's a situation where there's strangulation because of the war that's going on around it. There is an inability to get the aid in, never mind the bureaucratic obstacles that are put in place by both the Saudis and the Houthis. And so the prospect now is that the ceasefire agreement doesn't hold. We're seeing increasing numbers of people losing their lives, 100 civilian casualties per week in Yemen, more Yemenis being killed at home than in any other place because they are vulnerable to this war.
The narrative out of Washington looks like this. A lot of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle came together to try and end U.S. participation in this terrible Yemen war. And it looks like Trump wants this war to go on. But is it possible that maybe the war will accelerate and get to peace sooner? Is that even part of Trump's calculation?
This is a war that isn't going to be solved by more bombing. It's not going to be solved by greater arms supplies. It's not going to be solved by more refueling, which is precisely what the resolution was trying to tackle. President Trump's determination that the most important thing is simply to support Saudi Arabia because they're opposed by the Iranians, I'm afraid leads Yemen to the precipice. I mentioned the fact that it's already had the second largest cholera outbreak in the world. It's got the risk that 10 million people will fall from malnourishment into famine. And the danger of this decision by President Trump is that it gives a green light to a failed strategy, and it gives succor to those on the Saudi side who would say that it's impossible to negotiate a settlement and therefore double down on the war strategy.
David Miliband heads the International Rescue Committee. He's also a former British foreign secretary. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It took just a couple of days for nearly $1 billion to get pledged internationally to help rebuild Notre Dame in Paris. Meanwhile, the United Nations is struggling to meet its goal of raising about $300 million for countries like Mozambique that were devastated by Cyclone Idai last month. The storm left more than 1,000 people dead and hundreds of thousands of people in need of aid. So what drives Good Samaritans to donate to certain causes over others? I asked Michael Sanders, a behavioral economist in London, who's written about this.
Donating to charity it's not a rational act. It's a psychological and emotional and a social act. So when we see a cause, we have to make a decision about whether to donate to it. And a lot of the time that comes down to what we call social distance. So how much can I relate to the thing that the cause is trying to say, trying to support? So in the case of the Notre Dame fire, we can all imagine, or certainly most of us can, a time when we've been inside a very impressive cathedral in a Western city and how grand and how amazing that was and how much that gives you a sense of history. Whereas the victims of a natural disaster half a world away, even if, you know, we can all say rationally in our mind that is a much worse, much larger tragedy, more deserving of a donation and support, even though we know that rationally, psychologically, it's a little bit harder for us to make that leap and to make that kind of decision to donate.
It's ironic, isn't it, that so many heartstrings were pulled about a pile of bricks, not to put it bluntly, but Notre Dame is a building, and in Mozambique, we're talking about 1,000 people dead. So wouldn't you think people would find the suffering of other people more salient than a burned building?
So under normal circumstances, all else being equal, we would expect to see more money donated to Mozambique than to some bricks and mortar and wood and some glass being set fire to in Paris. I guess the point around the salience, though, is that all else isn't equal. So I watched the news the other evening when the fire was happening, and there wasn't 6 hours of wall-to-wall coverage of the tragedy in Mozambique. Not to speak ill of you while I'm being interviewed by you, but that responsibility slightly lies with the media.
How much does $1 donated to Notre Dame in Paris fare versus $1 given to Mozambique or any place in Southern Africa right now? Can you parse that out?
Certainly a dollar spent in Paris will not go anywhere near as far as a dollar spent in Mozambique. And certainly what you're thinking about doing with that dollar, so investing it in saving artwork or bricks or mortar or building some sort of monument, don't know what the plan is, it's certainly not going to achieve, we wouldn't expect, the same amount of human kindness and of benefit to the society as $1 spent on food or medication. The best money you can spend in a general sense on a day-to-day basis is on deworming and on bed nets. So deworming and bed nets have both been shown to have really, really huge effects on the well-being, the health of people in the developing world, and to have huge spillover effects, deworming in particular.
Michael, how do you think we could start paying attention and giving to charities helping countries like Mozambique recover from natural disasters? I mean, I accept that some of that is on our shoulders, we in the media.
So I think, as you say, some of it is on your shoulders. I think while we recognize that we shouldn't just buy candy or chocolate when we get to the checkout in the store, just based on our emotions, we don't really seem to get that we should do the same kind of deliberative process for our charitable donations. In the same way as you wouldn't think about investing your life savings in a fund without seeking the advice of an independent financial advisor.
Michael Sanders is a behavioral researcher in the UK who's written about the science behind why people give money to charity. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you very much.
a U.S. attack on Cuba. That's what Havana is calling Washington's decision to allow Americans, including Cuban-born U.S. citizens, to sue foreign companies doing business in Cuba, business that involves assets and property seized by the communist government decades ago. It's a provision in a U.S. law that passed in 1996, but that every president since has blocked. Not Trump. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made the announcement today.
Any person or company doing business in Cuba should heed this announcement. Those doing business in Cuba should fully investigate whether they are connected to property stolen in service of a failed communist experiment.
A lot of European companies do business in Cuba. Chris Bennett in London advises some of them as managing director of the Caribbean Council. Here are some of his main concerns.
One is the suspension of Title IV of Helms-Burton, which effectively means that if there is a claim in a U.S. court against a European citizen or a European investor who has presence in Cuba and activity in Cuba, they would have their visa access to the U.S. prevented, so they wouldn't be allowed to travel to the U.S. The second area in which it will affect UK and EU companies is that they may be subject for claims or have claims against them, not only by U.S. interests and U.S. corporations, U.S. citizens who were expropriated during the Cuban Revolution in 59, but in Cuban Americans who were Cubans at the time of the revolution and who before 1996 became U.S. citizens, which means there is a vast number of people who have claims in Cuba.
How exposed are European businesses today in these investments? Are you able to put a dollar amount on what could be claimed?
I don't have a dollar amount for you. There are obviously very significant investments, particularly by Spanish investors in the hotel space in Cuba, which is a very significant economic area of activity. There are also significant investments in cigars and in rum, all of which are potentially subject to suits from US or Cuban-American claims. So, yes, I think there are some substantial concerns there.
How hard will it be for them to kind of track the chain of custody back to the communist takeover?
I think that's a really good question, and I think that that is going to be a significant challenge, actually. But there will be tests that need to be met in terms of mounting that claim, in terms of proving ownership of the original asset, proving that you were actually expropriated, proving that no compensation was provided or offered to you, and proving that the foreign investor, if you were going after a foreign investor, that the foreign investor knowingly is trading in a confiscated asset. It is a very loose, ambiguous language that's used in terms of trafficking in confiscated assets, and it's not clear what trafficking means, and it's not clear how the courts will interpret that.
Do you think we're looking at a future where it's just an unsustainable barrage of lawsuits?
What I would say is that the damage that this will do is that a lot of these lawsuits will remain pending over a period of potentially years. And even if there is a policy change and Title III and Title IV are suspended again, those lawsuits will be effectively frozen in ASPIC and will still be there, and there will be effectively any of those assets will have a claim sitting on them, which will continue to damage the investment environment for Cuba and prevent international investors looking at Cuba.
Chris Bennett, the managing director of the Caribbean Council, speaking with us from London about the latest U.S. policy changes toward Cuba. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thanks very much.
What's really involved in redacting a document like the Mueller report? That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Tomorrow morning, a redacted version of the Mueller report will be released by the Attorney General, which means big chunks of the document will be blacked out, officially to protect sensitive information. And that's just fine with President Trump.
Well, I have great confidence in the Attorney General. And if that's what he'd like to do, I have nothing to hide.
But how do we really know what the DOJ is blotting out? For some answers, we turn to Tom Blanton. He directs the National Security Archive at George Washington University in D.C. I asked him first off about how the text is blacked out.
It's done on computers these days. They actually highlight texts that they think are still sensitive, and they zap them. And they have to, under the Freedom of Information Act, they have to put out to the side what exactly they're citing, what exemptions.
Do you know of cases where two censors disagreed?
Oh.
And what happens then?
On the wall at the National Security Archive office down at George Washington University, we have a piece of White House email that was sent to Colin Powell when he worked in the White House at high levels. And the two versions are almost mirror images in the sense that the top and bottom of one version are blacked out. The middle of the second version are blacked out, but the top and bottom are released. And they were declassified 10 days apart. The punchline, it was the same reviewer both times. I called him up. His name was on the document. What were you thinking? He says, well, there was probably something in the Washington Post sensitive about Libya the first week, so I had to cut that paragraph out. But the next week, it wasn't Libya. It was the Saudis or something, so I had to cut that paragraph out. And so you get completely opposite views. My point is just that so much of the secrecy really is subjective. Even the sources and methods of intelligence that are so well known in the world today, they're not real secrets. But the government's point of view is it makes a difference if we acknowledge it. Therefore, you can have it on the front page of the New York Times, but that doesn't mean we can't still black it out when we want.
So with the Mueller report, what would have happened if there had been disagreement about what to include and what not?
My bet is that the Attorney General would not have had the folks in the room who would disagree with him. There's a kind of a self-selection process among groups of censors. What we found over two decades of fighting the subjective secrecy is that the key to getting the most open version of a document is having multiple pairs of eyes from multiple bureaucratic locations take a look at it. There's an appeals panel that is of multiple agencies, and they overrule the original agency saying it was secret. They overrule them 70-75% of the time. It's so subjective.
What about the rules or standards for redactions that we're using today? Have they been in place for a long time?
They change from administration to administration. The standards we have now in national security have been in place since Obama did an executive order, and his order overturned an earlier order that George W. Bush had done and dramatically opened up a lot of the national security world. On the standards for withholding informant material and law enforcement material, those have really been developed by the courts over many years. So there's multiple court decisions that lay out pretty rigorous procedures for what can be protected. I think the FBI has even won a court case saying that an informant's name from 70 years ago could still be censored from a today document because the plaintiffs couldn't prove the person was dead. There wasn't an obituary, there wasn't a death notice. And if you can prove they were dead, then they're still protected, they still get redacted.
If the standards, though, change in future administrations, is it possible that years down the line, some of these redacted passages in the Mueller report could be revealed to the general public?
Absolutely. It's like peeling an onion. We've gotten copies of high-level documents over the years through Freedom of Information cases where first version comes out, half of it's withheld. And gradually over time, I think the entire text will come out. And when people are doing the anniversaries decades down the road, they were more likely to have a complete copy of the Mueller report than we're going to get.
Do you think most of these documents deserve to be classified in the first place, though?
A lot of them do in the first place. The big argument is over how long they stay secret, how long they stay in the vault. And that's the big argument, I think, even with the redactions in the Mueller report. How really secret are they, and how long are they going to have to stay secret? Pretty much everybody, even in the security business, would say that most classified documents can be released within a period of 5, 10, 15 years. Only if it's like design of a weapon system that would empower some thug in some foreign country to really create danger for American citizens, then I think they have a basis for classifying that. Same thing with some brave Iranian who walks into our embassy and wants to give us the lowdown on the Ayatollah's succession but asks for anonymity. you probably want to protect that person's identity for as long as, you know, there's some danger to them. So there are some real secrets, and that's where I differ from people like Assange and even Chelsea Manning, who just kind of wanted to throw it all up against the wall. Nothing should be secret. I disagree. Things that would really hurt people, they should be secrets. Things that are bottom lines in a diplomatic negotiation, probably until that negotiation's done, that can be a real secret. But most of the classified universe does not deserve to stay secret more than a couple of years.
And we should point out that sloppy redactions have created a lot of problems, right? I think of the ability to lift up the black bars if you don't know what you're doing putting the black bars in the first place.
I think that's going to be that's Attorney General Barr's worst nightmare. A couple years back, the Justice Department, under duress of a lawsuit, had to release this internal consultants report. People had heard about it on the outside, exposed racism problems, discrimination problems within the Justice Department. The Office of Justice redacted it using a computer program, putting black blotches on. It comes out in the public. Somebody realizes, oh, that's just an Adobe Acrobat. Oh, I can peel that off. And they peeled off the black. And what was under there was all this embarrassing stuff about Justice Department employees complaining to their supervisors and never getting any justice out of it. So that's their worst nightmare. At the Central Intelligence Agency today, they print out the document with the black blotches and then rescan the hard copy to send it to us electronically. So you can see they're worried about that.
Many people will cry foul given the redactions in the Mueller report. Will there be lawsuits challenging some of the blacked out sections, do you think?
I think there already are lawsuits. There are a number of Freedom of Information cases that are already in court. And those plaintiffs have some tools at their disposal. Judges have the right to look at a redacted document in camera, as they say, in their chambers, and that judge can decide for him or herself, was that redaction justified or not? A lot of times judges don't directly overturn a government decision. They just order the government to do another review. And then when you do another review, a lot of times you get a different result. The judges do have the power to push back dramatically. The judge just has to have a backbone.
Tom Blanton directs the National Security Archive. Thanks for talking redactions with us, Tom. Appreciate it.
A pleasure to be with you, Marco.
Tomorrow on The World, we'll be all over the Mueller report with a review of what's in the redacted version, plus reaction from Russia and much more. I'm Marco Werman. Before the Tiananmen Square massacre 30 years ago, there was a season in China when freedom seemed possible.
That winter, 88-89, was probably one of the freest winters ever in China.
Remembering how the Tiananmen protest began, that's coming up ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Dramatic news out of Peru today. A 2-time former president of the country, Alan Garcia, is dead. Peruvian authorities say he committed suicide rather than face arrest on corruption charges. Simeon Tagle is a reporter based in Lima. He says it was a startling scene earlier today at Garcia's house in the Peruvian capital.
So police showed up at 6:30 this morning to issue an arrest warrant. He initially appeared cooperative and asked to go to his bedroom to call his lawyer. He went in there, locked the door, and after a few minutes, a gunshot was heard. Police then forced their way in and found Garcia sitting with apparently a gunshot wound to his head.
How were Peruvians reacting to this news?
I think it's fair to say that this news has really rocked Peru. Alan Garcia is, or at least was, a towering political figure here. He was twice president from 1985 to 1990, and then from 2006 to 2011, and was probably the most able politician of recent Peruvian history. But he's also been, in the last few years, a reviled figure. He ran for re-election in 2016 and got just 6% of the vote. And the reason for that is this widespread perception that he was corrupt. His first presidency ended in hyperinflation and all kinds of graft allegations against him. Garcia then left the country and was living in Paris while the statute of limitations ran out. He was re-elected in 2006, but his second term was marred by the Odebrecht mega scandal. Odebrecht is this Brazilian construction company that has admitted paying more than $1 billion in bribes to politicians across Latin America in return for public contracts. Alan Garcia presided over more contracts for Odebrecht than any other president in recent Peruvian history.
There was an arrest warrant this morning before he killed himself. Does that suggest that Alan Garcia would have gone to trial and maybe even served time?
That's what seemed to be on the cards. Basically, Peruvian prosecutors have just reached this agreement with Odebrecht in Brazil that allows the company to turn over what it knows about its corrupt acts in Peru to the prosecutors here without fear of Odebrecht executives being themselves prosecuted. By the latest count, the company had admitted to paying something like $29 million in bribes within Peru. And from the leaks that are coming out in the Peruvian press, it seemed that Garcia was heavily implicated. Just over the weekend, one of the big revelations was that Luis Nava, Garcia's personal secretary, had received $4 million from Odebrecht. I guess the obvious question is how much of that money was actually meant for him and how much of it was meant for his boss. But it did seem that the net was closing in on Garcia.
Reporter Simeon Tagle in Lima, Peru. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
On a spring night in the Chinese capital 30 years ago, college students started walking out of their dormitories. They were marching, chanting slogans. Nothing terribly extraordinary, except in China in 1989, it was very extraordinary. Soon, a massive protest was underway in Tiananmen Square, and we now know how it all ended. A massacre with unknown hundreds of people killed by Chinese soldiers. When the protest started, though, there was a sense of hope. Ilaria Maria Sala was an exchange student in Beijing at the time. She's on the line with us from Hong Kong, where she's based as a journalist, frequently writing for Quartz. How did these student protests begin? Remind us, if you would, Ilaria.
They started spontaneously when students heard that Hu Yaobang had died of a heart attack. He was a former party leader who had been disgraced in 87 because he had supported the student demonstrations that had happened in 86, 87. He was very well known in China for being a reformist. So one of the worries that the student had was that the party was going to give him a subdued, small funeral, and they wanted him to have a state funeral.
So the students were simply wanting to honor Hu Yaobang because he supported them. What were your Chinese classmates saying about this protest?
Well, it wasn't just about Hu Yaobang. It was also a way to tell the leaders at the time that they were not as popular as Hu Yaobang had been. Mm. There was a feeling of discontent, a feeling that party loyalty counted more than loyalty to socialist principles. And also corruption was starting to be more widespread than it had been previously. And political reforms were stalling. So it was so much freer than it is today. Control was much less intense. So if I think back on those days, some of the grievances that the students were expressing, especially in terms of political reforms, seem now quite impossible to replicate. What was happening then was way more open than what we have today.
Yeah, I want to get back to that in a moment because hindsight is really important here. When did you go, actually, Ilaria, to see the protests at Tiananmen Square yourself? And what did you think? What were your first impressions?
Because protests of this sort were a rarity, the previous ones had been more than 2 years before, and a major leader had been punished for supporting them. The students were very careful to know who they were with. So they made sure that everyone would march with their classmates, which were then divided by department and divided by university, so that every moment you could look around you and only see known faces. And if someone wasn't a familiar face. You could say, who is this person? Is this a plainclothes policeman who's following us or something like this? So there was quite a heightened sense of security. And then through the night, nobody knew whether there was going to be some violence or whatever. So the students made sure that myself and a few other foreigners that were there were in a safe place. So we were put around the monument to the people's heroes, so that from there, if anything would have happened, we would have been protected by our Chinese classmates.
Did that make you worried? Were you scared?
I guess we were too naive to be scared, but I felt very grateful that people were so concerned about my safety. At the same time, my Chinese classmates all seemed to think that it was going to be okay, that this was so important. Maybe at the worst, what people had feared was that maybe someone might have been roughed up, but not much more than that.
We think of China today and we do not think democracy. And I'm surprised now to learn of a slow emergence of freer expression in China on the eve of Tiananmen. Do you ever wonder, Ilaria, kind of what if there hadn't been this violent sea change, if the central government had allowed a steady growth of pluralism?
Of course I do. The only answer to this is that if they had given what the students were asking or what was in the air before April, May, and especially June, we wouldn't have a one-party state in China. That winter, 88-89, was probably one of the freest winters ever in China. There were a lot of different publications. Even the state channel was broadcasting programs that were quite critical of the government, quite critical of social problems. People among themselves were speaking in a way that has never replicated itself since. Professors at school would be super critical. We would read newspaper articles that were even raising the possibility that Mao Zedong had been wrong.
Mm.
So had that continued that way, I don't think the Communist Party would have managed to stay in power.
What about now? Because today we see this unprecedented level of control by the Chinese Communist Party. Connect the historical dots.
For me, at least personally, one of the greatest lessons of this is how much propaganda works. Throughout these 30 years, the level of propaganda, the level of control, the level of convincing people that a different kind of reality took place has been pretty successful in a way that can be scary, because we all want to think that we are independent thinkers, and yet we are so easily manipulated. And one of the things that I see now is how much people believe that without all these controls, without this AI-enhanced facial recognition, etc., life would be really dangerous, that such a large country can only be controlled through that. I am surprised how much people actually have convinced themselves of this.
Ilaria Maria Sala is a journalist from Italy based in Hong Kong today. She's been recalling her time in Beijing as an exchange student 30 years ago during the Tiananmen Square student uprising. Ilaria, thank you very much for your thoughts.
You're welcome.
This coming July, Japan plans to resume commercial whaling, even as the country's appetite for whale meat is at an all-time low. So what is Japan's attachment to whaling all about? Abigail Leonard reports from Tokyo.
Tsukiji Fish Market in Tokyo sells just about every kind of seafood imaginable, including whale. There's a stand out front that sells whale cooked all sorts of ways, fried, grilled, bacon style. Most of the customers here today remember eating whale as kids. Like this man in his 50s who says he ate it in school, stir-fried with ketchup. I ask him if he liked it.
No, I don't like it.
The Japanese have whaled for centuries, but consumption really peaked after World War II. The country was devastated and food was scarce. So American occupation authorities urged them to eat more whale as a cheap source of protein.
Obviously, there's more to whaling than meets the eye.
This is an American newsreel from the time.
The whale hunt will help alleviate Japan's food shortage and ultimately save over $20 billion for American taxpayers.
Just after the war, half of all protein in the Japanese diet was whale meat. Today, it's much, much less. People here eat only about 40 grams a year per capita, about the size of a slice of ham. At the whale restaurant, I asked a woman how often she eats it.
Barely, very low, almost never.
Under international rules, Japan can hunt whales that aren't endangered for scientific research. But the meat is sold commercially, and there's a huge surplus of it stored frozen in warehouses across the country. In January, the stockpile reached 3,700 tons. Still, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government continues to support whaling, to the tune of $50 million in this year's budget. The Secretary General of Abe's party, Toshihiro Nikai, even gave interviews from the government cafeteria while dining on whale curry. He's saying, "It was excellent. I've never eaten such delicious curry. We must spread the idea throughout Japan that whale meat is something we can't do without." Then, late last year, the government announced Japan would pull out of the International Whaling Commission, the body that regulates whaling, and resume commercial whaling in July. So, at this point, it's fair to ask, with all the criticism Japan gets for hunting whales, and it gets a lot, plus the fact that very few people here even eat it, why is this country so committed to whaling? I went to see Joji Morishita, who negotiated Japan's upcoming withdrawal from the International Whaling Commission.
Eating a whale issue is a symbol of respect for a different culture. And many people in Japan think that it's not right for people from outside to impose food culture to other places.
There's something else going on here, though. Junko Sakuma, a researcher at Rikkyo University, says Japan originally designed its research program back in the 80s, and it had to tell the Whaling Commission ahead of time how many whales it would catch.
Japan would go to the International Whaling Commission with a long-term target, like they say they'll catch 100 whales a year. But because it's supposedly for research, they can't reduce the number of whales they catch, even if consumption declines.
But now that they're resuming commercial whaling, they're actually expected to kill fewer whales. In fact, the anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd called it a positive development. The group's boats have actively tried to block Japan's whale hunts. And Sakuma says that may have had an unintended effect.
The ironic thing is that Sea Shepherd's activities actually seem to increase Japanese support for whaling. There's this feeling about them like, here are these Westerners coming to Japan and telling us our culture is wrong.
In a survey, Sakuma found 70% of Japanese are pro-whaling. It's a point of national pride. When Japan announced it would leave the International Commission, Sakuma says politicians were all over the news, hailing it as a victory for whaling culture. At Tsukiji Market, almost every customer I talk to tells me they hardly ever eat whale, but they still want to protect Japan's whaling culture. Koichi Matsumoto, who owns the whale restaurant, welcomes that. But he doesn't expect the change to commercial whaling to make much of an impact on people's eating habits.
Consumption is already so low, it's not suddenly going to skyrocket.
But he is hopeful that with the right kind of marketing, people might even double their consumption of whale. In other words, going from the size of roughly one slice of deli meat a year to two. For The World, Abigail Leonard, Tokyo.
It's that time of year when it's relatively safe to climb Mount Everest. Hundreds of people will attempt to reach the summit. 99% of them will take one of two standard routes. But two climbers, American Corey Richards and Ecuadorian Esteban Topo Mena, will be attempting to chart a brand new route up the world's tallest mountain. If they succeed, it'll be the first new line up Everest in at least 10 years. Corey and Topo actually met on Everest in 2016. They told me that they'd sit at base camp, stare at the rock passageway that bisects the northeast face of the mountain, and think, someone should definitely try going up that way.
You know, since the first time we both went, it was just, oh my God, that is so beautiful. And it's amazing that nobody has done it yet. So, yeah.
A team went to attempt it in 2015, a very strong team of climbers. And that was that tragic earthquake that year.
Right.
So the mountain sort of closed down and they left. And nobody's been back since. So it's not going to stay unclimbed forever.
People might be familiar with the idea of hiring guides to plan a climb up Everest and the Sherpas to carry their stuff. But for people who don't know, in the climbing world, you guys are professional climbers in a totally different league. How are you planning this ascent? What else is unique about this one?
Well, the uniqueness about this climb is, well, A, you know, that we are trying to climb something that hasn't been climbed yet. We're not going to use oxygen, supplemental oxygen. That's the next thing. And the level of support, like you well described, we won't have that support. It's just the two of us.
So a new untrodden path, no Sherpas, no oxygen. Like, what is happening to your body when you're not on oxygen on a mountain like Everest?
So, to put it simple, you probably start dying slowly. Just imagine like having a plastic bag over your head and your vital body functions start to fail, like slowly, as, you know, first maybe your mind and then, you know, your heart, your stomach, like everybody just sort of shuts down slowly.
You're accepting to do this now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oxygen is the ultimate dope, right? It's like, that's what our body, that is the ultimate doping. It just makes everything so much easier.
Are you concerned about fatality?
Of course.
Yeah, that's a possible consequence. That's a possible price to pay, you know, if things go wrong. But
is there a certain point on the ascent where you just have to put that out of your mind?
I don't know that there's actually a certain inflection point or this turning point. If you get to a turning point where you have to make a decision to put death out of your mind, you're probably in a pretty bad situation. Oftentimes people are like, oh, you're an adrenaline junkie. And the truth is, if I'm feeling adrenaline, I've probably already screwed up.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. So, you know, it's like that's not what we're going there to do.
You sound like old hands at this because basically you are. So what was the first time you tried summiting Everest? Let me start with you, Corey.
Oh, yeah. So the first time I tried to climb Everest was a tragic failure. I mean, it was a horrific mess. I just went in with a lot of hubris and unwarranted ego, and I got really put in my place, and rightfully so. I mean, I went there with Conrad Anker, and it was in the North Face in 2012, and we were on a National Geographic expedition, and I had had some PTSD from being buried in an avalanche on Gasherbrum 2 in Pakistan in winter. I just was not ready to be there, and it was a really spectacular and public failure.
But to know that you're not equipped is also experience, too. Topa, what about you?
My first time was in 2013. I was 23 years old at the time.
Mm. What makes you guys a good team? Like, how do your climbing styles mesh?
First of all, you know, the old sort of style of climbing was that there was sort of a lot of machismo. It wasn't a lot of communication. Topo and I talk about everything. We talk about our strengths. We talk about our weaknesses. We talk about what's bothering us. We talk about where I'm going to need help, where he's going to need help. And beyond that, you know, Topo's he's a beast, and I am more of like, I'm not.
he is a beast.
So there's, you know, we have different strengths in the mountain. And what do you think about that, Topo?
For me, really, it's a matter of, you know, trusting each other. Like, I really know that I'm going to climb this route with someone that I can trust my life on, you know, and that's what makes, you know, a team, ultimately. Like, you know, the goal is big enough to make our hands sweat, you know, like we know that we need each other's abilities to make it happen. We wouldn't be able to do it alone, but also we can really trust on each other. And that's just the base of any good team.
Mm. Best case scenario, you make the summit by setting a new course. What is the second best scenario?
We just don't die. Now, I mean, we always, there's these three sort of tenets of climbing, which is, you know, in order, come home, friends, go to the top. And so if you do those three things, that's successful, you know.
So you're both raising funds for this ascent to the Everest summit on a new route, no ropes, no oxygen. It is expensive. I mean, tens of thousands of dollars expensive. I do struggle a bit to understand, why spend all this money? Why take the enormous personal risk? What actually drives you at the end of the day?
Well, first and foremost, it's important to understand that climbing comes from a place of privilege. And we are in a time right now where it's important to look at privilege, own it, and talk openly about it. The other piece of that, though, is that we can't necessarily take back where we come from or the sort of the careers that we've fallen into. And, you know, climbing has personally helped me build a small but somewhat potent platform to talk about things that are really meaningful to me.
And what is your platform?
What I'm very, very passionate about because of my own history is mental health. I do struggle personally with bipolar disorder and major depression. And climbing has been a way to find some sort of meaning in my own life, especially when I was younger and searching for that.
Topo, what about you? What drives you? What drives you up a mountain like Everest?
You know, sometimes we climb and it's cloudy and it, you know, you don't really see it, but it's all about the connection with the mountain. I guess since ancient times, people's been getting to the top of things, right? So it's just this feeling of, you know, being driven to go somewhere that's wild, that's hard, that, you know, it's going to require the best out of you and, you know, be connected with something that you don't really understand, but just pushes you to give the best you have.
Esteban Topo Mena and Corey Richards on their way to another Everest summit, this time on a new route with no oxygen, ropes, or guides. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It was fun.
Yeah,
let's do it when we get back.
Absolutely. Plan
All
on.
All right, dude.
Bye-bye.
Sounds great. Take care.
Corey and Topo have now reached base camp on the Tibet side of Mount Everest. Their expedition to the summit could take up to 2 months, depending on the weather. We look forward to hearing their stories when they get back. That is The World on this Wednesday from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.